Kia ora and welcome to The Week in Review. I'm Paul Brennan with a selection of stories and interviews in RNZ News this week. Coming up in this podcast, the final hours of Grace Mullane's life are shown to a High Court jury. Shut up shop, that's the message to Oranga Tamariki from a prominent Māori leader. And victims of the country's largest Ponzi scheme are angry insolvency law reforms have been shelved.
We were promised Ponzi-specific legislation that was very crisp, very clear, very fair, and would have provided a very, very quick settlement.
Coming up in the Week in Review. But first, Christopher Luxon has been selected as the National Party's candidate for the Botany electorate. Mr. Luxon put forward his name less than a month ago after 6 years as Air New Zealand's chief executive. He'll contest the seat held by Jamie Lee Ross, who quit National last year in spectacular fashion to become an independent MP. Our reporter Jordan Bond was at the selection meeting. He filed this for Tuesday's morning report.
It gives me tremendous pleasure to tell you that the National Party candidate for 2020 for the electorate of Botany will be Christopher Luxon.
Christopher Luxon successfully takes his first political step. But with future leader tags all over him, he quickly shut down questions about any near future leadership aspirations.
We've got an awesome leader in Simon Bridges. He is a very talented, very experienced guy. That's what this country needs right now. We need to make him Prime Minister immediately because we can't afford another 3 years adrift.
The Botany electorate has elected the National Party candidate by a large majority each election since its establishment in 2008. It'd be a big upset if Mr. Luxon loses the election in a year's time. One of his competitors is the now independent MP Jamie Lee Ross.
Don't really care what he does. I can't control what he does, but what I can control is how we hold our campaign. What we do and how we do it really matters here.
Mr. Luxon was chief executive of Air New Zealand for the better part of 7 years, during which the airline won a host of awards, including the world's best airline. But politics is a different game. He spoke about learning and listening and starting from the ground up.
My real ambition, as I said, is to represent Botany exceptionally well. I've got a lot to learn as being a very, very good local member.
He says he's against the voluntary euthanasia bill, recreational cannabis and abortion reform, but is for medicinal cannabis. But he says he could be swayed by what his constituents think. So what are his political values?
Well, it's about personal responsibility. It's about a reward for achievement. It's about caring for people and doing the job for people. I love this country, I love this electorate, and I want to be able to find a way to give back.
Mr. Luxon rejected assertions he's been helicoptered in for an easy win, saying he grew up and went right through school in the area and was selected by locals.
What I know I can tell you is I'm just interested in solving problems, and we have a lot of problems in this country. We are very good at platitudes, we've got very good at buzzwords and ideology, but we're not getting things done for people. And as a result, that means that we're not making a difference in daily people's lives, and that's something that we've got to work really hard at.
The National Party's campaign manager, Deputy Leader Paula Bennett, says he's got a lot to learn and a lot of doors to knock on over the next year.
He'll just have something to offer, and there's just no two ways about it. He's a talented guy that's, I know that we'll be running policy and things by him. But as you say, he's got a seat to win in Botany, and he can't take that for granted.
You happy?
Very happy. Absolutely wrapped with him.
Senior National MP Judith Collins says he'll be hitting the ground running and has impressed a lot of people.
I think he's done a great job. I think he's a very impressive person. He said to me just before, I've got a lot to learn from you. And I said, well, maybe, Christopher, I've got a lot to learn from you. So I think he's got a great set of skills.
After a firestorm of National Party drama late last year, Botany MP Jamie Lee Ross will run as an independent. He says he has more to offer locals as an independent than a rookie MP sitting on the backbenches.
Jordan Bond with that report from Morning Report. And then Christopher Luxon joined Susie Ferguson.
Oh, look, it was a great night and it was a great process, to be honest, to go through. It's a pretty tough process. You end up going out and about and meeting a whole bunch of local folk who have been very committed to the electorate for some time. Botany's a pretty special place. It's really very diverse. It's got a whole bunch of New Zealanders that have come from all over the world to choose New Zealand to settle in, and it's got people that have lived there for a long time. And so it's a really interesting place.
So you obviously have gone through the selection process now, just so that I guess we begin to know you in a different capacity, not as Air New Zealand Chief Executive. What's your elevator pitch to the country as to why you should represent Botany?
Oh, well, look, it really is the fact that I think, you know, the country's in a stage of drift at the moment, and it really actually needs some things to happen, and actually we need to start getting some things done. And there are some really big issues across the country. If you think about infrastructure in particular, and we've talked about an infrastructure crisis. I travel all around the world and I've seen how other small countries are, you know, handle their infrastructure. We've really got some big work to do there. Secondarily, we've got some major issues. We still have a challenge to create more value in our business sectors, you know, whether it be primary industries or tourism or whatever, to create more value so that we can create higher wages and salaries. And that's a big problem for New Zealand for the last 30 years around productivity.
But you were working with the government on this to help strengthen its relationship with business through the Business Advisory Council. So where is it that Jacinda Ardern's going wrong?
Well, look, I think the Prime Minister is a dedicated New Zealander. She's an immensely talented communicator. But politics is actually, I think, more than just saying things. You actually have to get things done. And the reality is the National Party under Simon Bridges has a tremendously balanced team, and they can actually get things done and actually deliver stuff. And that's really what matters for everyday New Zealanders.
But she's not a patch on the now Sir John Key?
Well, I think he was probably the greatest Prime Minister we ever had. His government was a pretty good period for New Zealand. And so that's our goal, is that in 2020 we have to get a National Party re-elected.
Are you going to move to the electorate if you win?
Something that we were just working through at the moment. I've got a whole bunch of family considerations to make, but I don't live that far away from the electorate. And, you know, to be honest, I'll be 100% committed to Botany, irrespective of where my head hits the pillow.
Okay. Let's just talk about some of your values, some of the things that you would sort of put a line in the sand on. You're against euthanasia. Why is that?
Well, look, my personal view is I'm pro-life. I'd be against capital punishment. I'd be against euthanasia, abortion. And my personal view is I'm opposed to the reforms. But what I am committed to is I'm now a constituent representative. And as a result, I need to be able to hear and get the views of my community that I represent. And so for me, over the coming year, that'll be a really important thing as I get out and about and hear people's views on subjects like that.
But indeed, people need to get your views on some subjects as well to get a sense of who you are. So why do you think that abortion should stay in the Crimes Act?
Look, my personal view is I'm just opposed to the reforms and I'm pro-life. And so,
but that's what it amounts to. You think that it's fair enough that it stays as a crime?
That my personal views about the reforms at this point, yep. And I want to be able to talk to my electorate about those issues. But I can tell you they aren't the major issues that people are talking about. They're talking about transport. They're talking about cost of living. They're talking about being able to get back home to their kids. They're talking about law and order. They're talking about infrastructure. Those things are what's mattering most.
Some of the stuff that people are talking about, certainly within the National Party, the ideas in the discussion document released the other day. Do you support, for example, cutting benefits to solo parents who don't vaccinate their children?
Well, look, I think the bottom line on our social and public policy is we have to put rights and responsibilities to the heart of what we're doing. And the reality is that, I watched a really interesting scenario play out with the situation of a police chase. And immediately the reaction from the media and the public was to blame the police rather than call for personal responsibility. And so those are things that I think are very important, that if you are part of...
I don't understand how that's answering the question that I asked you. Do you support cutting benefits to solo parents who don't vaccinate their children?
Yes, I do.
Why?
Because it's about a notion of rights and responsibilities. If you want to be part of New Zealand and a civil society, you have certain inalienable rights, but you also have responsibilities to actually for the collective and helping the collective of New Zealand.
Why just target solo parents and probably solo mums, really, if we're talking about it? Should that be extended? Should it be extended to cutting working for families benefits?
So it's not about that. It's about a principle about personal responsibility and about rights and responsibilities.
But why does that end simply with solo parents? Why does it not extend to working for families?
Well, it's a principle that actually needs to go across all of our social and public policy, right?
So it should extend that far?
It should.
So you would want to see working for families cut for parents who don't vaccinate their children?
Look, that's hypothetical. What I'm talking to you about is you asked me about a principle, and what I'm saying is you go through all the tactical issues around public policy or social policy. I want to be guided by a principle, and the principle very much is about rights and responsibilities. For example, you know, there's been a reduction in sanctions around people receiving benefits. If you don't show up for a job interview six or seven times, We have to have those kind of conversations. I mean, because the New Zealand taxpayer is helping someone who's in a vulnerable and a difficult situation, but they have a responsibility on their own personal case to actually do the best that they can.
You're already pinging on the preferred Prime Minister numbers in the polls. Now that you're selected as the candidate, do you anticipate that rising?
Look, I've got to be really focused on Botany and being the best MP for Botany. I think we've got an outstanding leader in Simon Bridges. I want him to be Prime Minister in 2020, and I certainly want to be part of his team. He's a very talented guy. I know him well. He's got the right temperament. He's got a great team around him that can actually hit the ground running and actually really deliver. And that's what this country needs. You know, we are drifting. We're not getting things done. We've got buzzwords, and that's what's happening.
Do you anticipate being in the front bench team, whether that's in government or opposition?
No, I'm really focused on, I've got a lot to learn. I'm really, you know, joining this process with much to learn from lots of different people. I really, you know, want to make sure that we deliver for the people of Botany. It's an important area. It's a big area. You've got a big population ultimately in East Auckland the size of Dunedin, and those people need to be incredibly well represented.
Christopher Luxon, who's been selected as the National Party's candidate for the Botany electorate, speaking on Tuesday's Morning Report. The final hours of Grace Mullane's life were shown to a High Court jury on Thursday. A compilation of hours of CCTV footage of the British backpacker enjoying a three-hour date in central Auckland with the man accused of her murder. The High Court heard that Grace messaged a friend during the evening to say, "I clicked with him so well," and that she would update her the next day. That was the last time the friend heard from Grace. And Ms. Mullane's mother broke down and left the courtroom as a police officer described explicit photos found on an iPhone. The Crown says they were taken of her daughter's body. Our reporter Sarah Robson is covering the case. She filed this for Thursday's Checkpoint program and a warning. This story contains details that may be distressing to some listeners.
Grace Mullane's parents, David and Gillian, watched intently from the public gallery as the final hours of their daughter's life were shown on big screens around the courtroom. The Crown took the jury through about an hour of CCTV footage gathered from around central Auckland, showing Ms. Mullane and the accused on a Tinder date. Prosecutor Robin McCoubrey asked Detective Adam Bicknell how much footage the police gathered.
The amount of CCTV that was collected in total was, I think, just short of 6 terabytes worth of data, which is a significant amount. Majority of that came from City Life Hotel.
So taking that as an example, what sort of period and how many cameras were you looking at for City Life Motel?
I believe City Life Hotel had 14 cameras. It recorded 24 hours a day. And we retrieved, I think it was 6 days worth of footage.
As well as footage from the City Life Hotel, the police were able to access CCTV cameras at the bars the pair went to, as well as cameras on the street.
Were you able to trace Ms. Mullane and the defendant's path on the night of the 1st of December, firstly, and then in the subsequent days?
Yes.
And so you were able, we're going to look at it in two halves during the trial, but you were able to trace where Ms. Mullane and the defendant went up until about 9:40 on the Saturday, is that correct, when they entered the City Life Hotel?
Yes.
The CCTV footage shows Ms. Mullane leaving Base Backpackers, where she was staying, and then arriving at Sky City.
And on the screen there at about 5:43 p.m., we see Ms. Mullane walking along Federal Street away from the camera.
Yes.
The footage shows Ms. Mullane standing near some large Christmas trees set up near the Sky Tower. There are other people milling around, and at one point Ms. Mullane is seen using her phone. The jury heard yesterday that the last message she sent her family in the UK was a picture of the Christmas trees from that spot.
There was what seems to be a speaker or something, or a light or something in the bottom of the screen in the middle, and then there's a gentleman in a high-vis jacket, and between those two, that's Ms. Mullane.
It then shows the accused in a blue jacket walking over to meet Grace Mullane and giving her a hug. The pair headed into Sky City, up the escalators and into Andy's Burgers and Bar on the first floor. They bought drinks and found a table. As part of their investigation, the police collected receipts from the places Ms. Mullane and the defendant went. Robin McCoubrey detailed what they bought.
seemed to be a number of cocktails on both tickets. Cuervo, is that tequila?
My understanding is yes.
And then a number of, as I say, cocktails on the top receipt, 7 in total, and 2 on the bottom receipt.
Ms. Mullane and the accused left Sky City and headed to the Mexican cafe, where they continued to drink heavily, buying jugs of margarita and sangria. They departed at about 8:30, and CCTV cameras filmed them walking through the CBD to the Bluestone Room. There, they settled in at a small table and ordered more drinks, beer, cider, and tequila shots. The bar was busy, and the pair kissed a number of times.
Seen the timestamp there, about 8:50 p.m.
Yes.
Again, the two of them kissing. So, Detective, this is about 3 hours after they met at Sky City. Is that accurate?
Yes.
At one point, the accused pulled Ms. Mullane closer by putting his arm around her shoulders. When the accused disappears from view, Ms. Mullane can be seen using her phone. And when Ms. Mullane is out of shot, he can be seen picking up and looking through her bag. They then left together and headed back to the man's apartment at the City Life Hotel. He had his arm around Ms. Mullane as they walked through the lobby and into the lift. That was at 9:40 on the night of December the 1st, and it was the last time Ms. Mullane was seen. During the date, the jury heard that Grace Mullane was messaging one of her best friends, Amina Ashcroft, via Facebook. Her evidence was read to the court by Crown Prosecutor Latia Tuiberevu. Ms. Ashcroft said Ms. Mullane told her the man she was on a date with was a manager at an oil company. Ms. Mullane messaged that he had an apartment in a hotel, to which her friend replied,
"You have to go to his apartment in the hotel, then bet it's like the top floor."
And Grace Mullane summed up her date to Ms. Ashcroft with this message.
"Literally, I clip with him so well. Then at 11:59 a.m, I will let you know what happens tomorrow."
Amina Ashcroft said Ms. Mullane seemed drunk but happy, and she didn't have any concerns for her safety.
Sarah Robson with that report from Checkpoint. And rigor mortis, extra large bag, and time in London are just a few things the man accused of murdering Grace Mullane searched for the night she died. The 27-year-old is on trial in the High Court at Auckland this month after pleading not guilty to murdering the British backpacker. The jury has now seen CCTV footage that showed them enjoying a Tinder date and heard what the defendant was doing at around 2 o'clock that morning. Our court reporter Annika Smith has been at the trial. She filed this for Friday's Morning Report.
Grace Mullane's mother broke down in court as a detective who worked on her daughter's case described what he found on her Tinder date's phone. Crown Prosecutor Robin McCoubrey walked through the chronology with Detective Samuel Luca. It began with the search Waitakere Ranges at 1:29 a.m. and hottest fire a few minutes later.
The next activity is at 1:41 a.m. where the website pornhub.com is accessed, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
And a video called Very Young Teen in Her Room is viewed.
Yes, that's correct.
The man then accesses further pornographic websites before a 30-minute break. Around 1:45 a.m. he takes 7 explicit photographs of Ms. Mullane's body. Mr. Luca's evidence was too much for Ms. Mullane's mother, Gillian, who began to cry before quickly leaving the room. The court also heard what was searched on the accused's phone the morning following the death. Here's a summary.
At 7:05 a.m, there's a Google search for rigor mortis. 2 searches for beaches on Google. Strandbags.co.nz. A Google search at 9:17 a.m. for large bags for carpet cleaner. There's then a further Google search for rigor mortis. Search for extra large bags. There's a Google search for time in London.
Later that afternoon, the man Googled Breaking News New Zealand, Flesh-Eating Birds, and Are There Vultures in New Zealand? The jury was also taken through CCTV footage that tracked the couple's movements around the CBD the previous evening. They went from bar to bar, drinking heavily after meeting up at the base of the Sky Tower. 3 hours into the date, they can be seen kissing and embracing in a pub. Ms. Mullane was actually messaging a friend, Amina Ashcroft, on and off during the date. She told her she'd clicked with the man, who she thought was a manager at an oil company, and lived in a hotel. Crown lawyer Lytia Tuiburerevu reads her statement.
I sense Grace was having a good time, and she seemed to be drunk and really enjoying herself. I do not think Grace had any concerns for her safety when I was in contact with her.
Ms. Mullane told her friend to let her know what happened in the morning, but that was the last Ms. Ashcroft heard from her. It's the Crown's case that the man strangled Ms. Mullane in his apartment later that night. But the defence say she died an accidental death after the pair engaged in rough sex with Ms. Mullane's consent and encouragement. The accused told the police the young woman had encouraged him to put his hands around her neck, but Ms. Ashcroft said Ms. Mullane had never expressed an interest in casual or rough sex.
Grace never met someone with the intention to sleep with them. It's an intimate thing for Grace to sleep with someone. Grace would have to be quite trusting and happy with that person. The impression I had was that Grace was practicing more conventional sex positions.
It's not disputed that the defendant put Ms. Mullane's body in a suitcase he later buried in a shallow grave in the Waitakere Ranges. The court has heard he went on a Tinder date with another woman while she lay dead in his apartment. ESR scientist Diane Krenfeld told the jury she identified a number of possible bloodstains in the room. Of particular interest was an Adidas sports bag and suitcase in a wardrobe.
I was advised that these bags had been seen on CCTV being removed from the building at the time of interest. I was also advised that the black sports bag, along with the bedding, had been taken to a dry cleaner's where it had been cleaned.
Ms. Krenfeld said there was no blood on the Adidas bag, but stains were found in the carpet, on the fridge and on the suitcase.
Annika Smith with that report from Morning Report. The former Dunedin doctor accused of murdering teenager Amber Rose Rush suggested to her mother the 16-year-old may have committed suicide. When that was dismissed, he offered the names of potential suspects in her murder. Vinod Scantha is on trial in the High Court at Dunedin. Timothy Brown has been following the case. He filed this for Wednesday's Checkpoint program.
Today, the jury heard from one of the witnesses who knew the 32-year-old accused best at the time of Amber Rose Rush's death in February last year. Vernard Scantha's former girlfriend, Bridget Clinton, gave evidence for much of today. She expected him to visit on the evening of February the 2nd, the day Miss Rush was killed. Prosecutor Richard Smith took Ms. Clinton through a text message exchange which followed when he didn't show up.
So that's now the early hours of Saturday,
yes,
the 3rd
correct.
Of February. He said, all right, I'm coming, geez. You've said, I'll paraphrase these, you don't want to see him. And then you've basically told him, don't come and you're done with him. Would that be fair enough?
Done with him, done with it.
But the accused arrived at her home in Balclutha, 80 kilometres from Dunedin, about an hour later with a teenage friend who has name suppression.
He turned up at my house between 2 and 2.30 a.m. and he said when he got there after a certain time that he just got those last messages then because he hadn't read them.
The group spent some time talking early that morning before they all went to bed. The Crown case is shortly before midnight, the teenage friend drove Mr. Scantha to Miss Rush's home in the Dunedin suburb of Corstorphine, drew a map of the house's layout on the dashboard of the car, and told him where to find a spare key. The Crown says the accused then entered the home, went to the teenager's bedroom, smothered her with pillows, and stabbed her to death to stop her coming forward with claims he was touching up minors, giving them alcohol, and offering money for sex. Ms. Clinton says when everyone awoke, Mr. Scantha suggested having a bonfire in her backyard. The three and her teenage son went to the warehouse to buy supplies for the fire, and Vernard Scantha bought her son a video game. She says her son found the video game wasn't in its case when they got home, so she took him back to the warehouse, and the fire was going when they returned.
That was when Vernard said that he was burning his daggiest clothes. You know, you get the fire going. And I had plenty of cardboard around. Yeah, and we're toasting marshmallows.
Vernard Scantha and his teenage friend stayed a second night in Balclutha before all three returned to Dunedin on February the 4th. Bridget Clinton says the trio visited Miss Rush's mother, Lisa Ann Rush, at a motel where she was staying later that day. She says on the way there, Mr. Scantha bought flowers and a card for her from the New World supermarket where Miss Rush had worked before her death.
I remember Vinod was seated next to her, talking to her, and suggested, you know, was it suicide? To which she absolutely vehemently said no. And then there were discussions about who could have done it, and I wouldn't say discussions, it was more him saying, oh, well, do you think it was X, Y, Z?
During cross-examination from defence lawyer Jonathan Eaton QC, Bridget Clinton says she thought Mr. Scantha was sympathetic at the time.
Generally, am I right that your assessment of how Vinod behaved there was that he appeared to be both sympathetic and he looked very concerned and sad for Lisa?
That was my impression at the time.
Yep.
Yep.
Mr. Scantha's teenage friend is expected to give evidence early next week.
Timothy Brown with that report from Checkpoint. Indignant and defensive, that's how Winston Peters has been described upon learning he had been paid too much superannuation over some 7 years. The High Court in Auckland on Wednesday heard from the Ministry of Social Development, with a manager laying bare her actions after discovering the overpayment. The legal action was launched by the New Zealand First leader, who argues his privacy was breached in the weeks before the 2017 election. Our deputy political editor, Craig McCulloch, is covering the case.
Meredith Nugent was an area manager for MSD in 2017, when Winston Peters' pension overpayment first came to light. And it was she who made the phone call to the New Zealand First leader, notifying him of the error.
He was very unhappy to be having that discussion, and his tone was indignant and defensive. He said it was a ministry error, and the clear undertone was, how dare we contact him about such a thing.
The two arranged to meet in person, where Ms. Nugent showed Mr. Peters his application form from 2010, in which he had declared he was separated and living apart from his wife. But he did not declare he was in a relationship with Jan Trotman.
Mr. Peters again told me that Jan Trotman had been at his initial interview. He also said that people should know who he is and also who she is, because there are always photos of them together and they're at functions.
Ms. Nugent told the court she concluded Mr. Peters had made an innocent mistake, that there was no intention to mislead or defraud the ministry.
He seemed legitimately surprised.
And Mr. Peters agreed to pay the money back. Once a number was calculated, nearly $18,000, it was left to Ms. Nugent again to make the phone call.
When I said who I was, he nearly bit my head off because he thought that I was a media person and he'd forgotten my name.
Mr. Peters' privacy case centres on what happens next, how news of the overpayment made its way to the media in the heat of the 2017 election campaign.
We did everything humanly possible to ensure that the overpayment was kept confidential.
And yet some journalists were tipped off by an anonymous source. Three reporters were subpoenaed by Mr. Peters' lawyer, Brian Henry, but none revealed identifying details.
Are you prepared to name the sources?
No.
I'm not willing to give any information that might reveal the identity of the source.
Did the person identify themselves to you?
No.
Ms. Nugent told the court she felt sick when she saw the story online.
You felt sick because you knew that somehow in your department Mr. Peters had been let down, didn't you?
No.
She went on.
I had no reason to understand how that information had made its way to the media.
Mr. Peters argues that ministry officials and the State Services Commissioner should never have briefed their ministers, his political opponents, about the overpayment, as it increased the risk of a leak. Tomorrow, those MPs, Nationals Paul Bennett and Anne Tolley, will give evidence in their defence.
Our Deputy Political Editor Craig McCulloch with that report from Wednesday's Checkpoint programme. Shut up shop now. That's the message to Oranga Tamariki from a prominent Māori leader. The chair of the Whānau Ora Commissioning Agency, Merepeka Raukawa Tate, says Oranga Tamariki has a toxic culture and has been riding roughshod over families, snatching babies without any consideration for the devastating intergenerational impacts. Her comments follow a damning report into an attempt to remove a six-day-old baby from his 19-year-old mother in Hawke's Bay. The internal review that identified a litany of errors prompted a public apology from the boss of Oranga Tamariki and immediate policy changes. On Friday's Checkpoint program, Merepeka Raukawa Tate told Lisa Owen nothing good will ever come from Oranga Tamariki and that the Crown should have nothing to do with the care of children.
I would prefer that we didn't have a State Department anywhere near, particularly Tamariki Māori. We have to accept, Māori have to accept, that we will own our own issues, we will provide the solutions, we will look to the people who are in the communities right now, and I'm talking very much about the Māori service providers, whānau ora navigators, and others who are in the community. They know the families, they're already easily identifiable, but we want early intervention and prevention. We want to strengthen and make those families strong. We know it can be done, but it's not going to be done by a government department pumping, as of this year, from the budget, another $1 billion to make them smarter at uplifting the children. No way. That should not be happening any longer.
So what do we do? Just close down Oranga Tamariki?
Well, that would be a damn good start, I have to say. Why do we need a big organisation to try and take... The state has never done a good job at caring for the children. So put that $1 billion that was allocated to them this year in the budget, put that into the families, into the organisations who don't have the money to do the breadth of the work that they should be doing, and they're doing very well with what they've got, but it's not adequate. Strengthen them, make sure that they can identify the homes that are safe, and in every whānau there is someone who will step up, but most of them don't have the financial resources to take on another two or three little ones into their home. So rather strengthen the families that strengthen than to strengthen a government department. That sort of thing should never happen.
So do you seriously think it's possible to shut up Oranga Tamariki and keep our children safe? Get rid of it altogether? I mean, when? Now?
Yes.
Right now?
I don't see why not. Well, first of all, there are another couple of reports to come out, reviews to come out. The one by the Commissioner for Children, the Human Rights Commission, and also the Ombudsman, Mr. Bouchier. So, and of course, we've got our own one, which is our Māori review as well, the Whānau Ora review. So we've got a number of reviews. All of them will be damning of the Oranga Tamariki. I'm absolutely convinced of that. Certainly they will have some recommendations, but I would like to say shut it down. Shut it down, get rid of it, have a core policy advisory ministry advising the minister, but everything else, the delivery of the services, the supporting of the families, the supporting of the mothers, all of the supports that need to get in, they should not be delivered by a government agency. No way.
So you are conducting your own inquiry, and without preempting the outcome of that, you've given a clear indication there that you think the outcome's going to be negative. You've interviewed, what, over 1,000 whānau.
That's
what are
right.
the common themes coming through here? Are the cases like the ones that we have seen in this report, or are they worse?
They are worse in some instances, but what we have seen is really a total disregard for the fact that Māori can look after themselves if giving the support to do so. We've got intergenerational uplifting of children, so there's families in one, two, three generations that have been uplifted. Now, what you can't tell me that somewhere along the line, resources couldn't have been applied to that family through accredited Māori provider, service provider, to be able to support that whānau to make the changes necessary. Otherwise, we're continually going to uplift Māori children and send them off to juvenile hall and into prison. We don't want to see that. The government says it's committed to making changes for Māori. If you are, then let Māori make the changes themselves. As hard as it might be for Māori to confront some brutal facts, and Lisa, there are some brutal facts that we have to confront, but the government won't confront those. Their only solution is get those kids out of there, separate the mothers from the children, and we know the lasting trauma that has, and the children never come back as adults, back to the whānau, so that they know their place. And so these are hard conversations that must be had
right.
by iwi amongst themselves, but it needs to be had.
When you talk about hard conversations and brutal facts, what exactly are you talking about? Because you know there are going to be people out there listening to you, Medipeka, who say, if Māori can look after their kids, why aren't they looking after them? Why are they overrepresented in statistics relating to abuse and poor treatment? You know that
well,
that's what people
yes,
will be asking.
Yes, I do know, but I have to say I have very little regard for those comments. First of all, what have those people ever done to assist Māori to be able to take their place in this country as full contributing citizens? What we have to understand is that in New Zealand we've had piss poor policy over many years that has relegated Māori to the sideline. We have seen structural reform come to this country in the 1980s that absolutely had a devastating effect on many Māori families. And so, you know, what we have to look at is what has happened. There's been a chronology of events in recent times, not going way back into historical times, into recent times, that have not supported and helped Maori families to get to the stage where they can contribute. And so we've seen all of this systemic racism and discrimination in our education system. I'm on a health board. I've been there for 9 years. I've just been re-elected for a fourth term. I can tell you, if you want to see discrimination, look to our health boards up and down this country. So all I'm just saying is that we have to support those families to know that there is another way that they can get through life. And it is with the support of the wider community, with knowing who they are, be proud of who they are, and knowing that they have a right to contribute in New Zealand society, that this is their country, and they have a right to be able to take their place and be fully contributing members. It's going to be hard because of where they've been parked up for such a long time, and that's no longer acceptable.
Are you angry, Meta Pekka?
I'm very, very angry, Lisa. I've been in this space for such a long time. I've seen what has happened for Māori women's access to justice when they come through the court system, when they try to report domestic violence, family harm, rape, all of these things. I've seen them brushed to the side, our children brushed to the side. And we continue to talk about, oh, Māori, why don't you pull yourselves up by your bootstraps? It's no longer acceptable. We have to see what have they had to cope with over all of these years, and still the government department is saying, we know what's best for you. They do not. Least government is best for Māori. We don't go to them for anything, really, if we can help it. No one's going to pick up the phone and say, or pick up the mobile and ring Oranga Tamariki and say, listen, there's a child in danger, we need your support. Nobody does that. That is one of the most, I think it's the most distrusted government department in this country because of what it does to children, what it does to families. And if there is no trust there, there is no relationship there, and nothing good will come of it.
Can it be redeemed? Can that trust be built?
I don't think so. I do know that recently there have been some accords, a memorandum of understandings with a number of iwis in the country. I think the iwi think that that's the best that they can do. I think we can do a lot better by getting this organisation out of our hair and saying to Māori families, you identify, if there's an issue in your family, you identify one person that we know you respect, you trust, and you would have no hesitation in putting your children in the care of that person. Let's strengthen that person. Let's look to see what other needs there are in the family. I mean, sometimes it's housing, it's no income, somebody's inside, there's truancy, there's ill health, mental health. All of those things impact on a family's ability to cope. Unfortunately, sometimes the weak and the vulnerable in the families wear it. That's not acceptable. We want our children and indeed everyone in the homes to be safe and to be well. But we have to strengthen the families. I don't want to see any more money going in to make a government agency smarter at uplifting children, Māori or others.
So those iwi that are signing memorandums with Oranga Tamariki, are they being
hoodwinked? I wouldn't say they're being, well, that was my expression, hoodwinked. I don't think so. I think they've entered into that in good faith and goodwill. But the only thing really is if there is going to be an uplift, they will be notified. Why don't they say no? We want to be right where, if there is any concern raised about one of our children in our rohe, we want to know. We want to act quickly. But the thing about it is, we should be there prior to the event. Most of the Māori uplifts in recent years, certainly a great percentage, have been of newborns. Well, you don't just have a baby overnight. You've got 9 months to identify somebody in that whānau or extended whānau or the hapū of the iwi. You've got midwives who can inform you. You've got everybody who could, the immediate and extended family, who could be developing a very, very robust plan for moving forward from the time the baby is born to see it's going to be safe. But more importantly, helping the young mother and the father to say, hey, listen, there's some concerns that we have. We need to make sure this baby's coming into a safe home. So get your A into G, and we're going to help you to make sure the changes in the home have been made. And it's not that difficult.
Meta Pekka, that newsroom video expose, it showed that a number of the Oranga Tamariki staff involved there, the frontline staff, they were Māori. Yet this agency failed to maintain the mana of the family, consult with the whānau, and look at wider placements. Can you be Māori and operate within Oranga Tamariki and be true to kaupapa Māori? Does Oranga Tamariki allow that to happen?
That's a very good question, Lisa, and I don't think you can. And certainly not in the organisation that it was, and I believe there has been an attempt to change that, and I know there has. But when you've belonged, and those, the social workers that I saw there were of a certain age. They weren't young. They weren't newcomers to this area of work. So what has happened, I believe, is they've become institutionalised as well, in terms of they know the system, they can throw the book at you, they can read the regulations backwards and frontwards, but it doesn't help, and it's certainly not a cope up a Māori way. I mean, if you were to come to Te Aroha or anywhere else and say, this is how we're going to uplift a baby in your rohe, which has happened, I might add, then we don't want to see that happen. It's happened in the past, and it shouldn't be happening now. And this is what the Minister and the CEO didn't want to see, and yet 2 years down the track, that is still going on. That sort of behaviour has been institutionalised within those senior social workers. And for them to make a call like that and to be so disrespectful and distrustful of the family, the kaumātua and the midwives, I just think that was disgraceful behaviour. So, shame on them. Shame on them.
So what are you telling your Māori families in the way they should deal with Oranga Tamariki?
Well, first of all, I say they should never be speaking to Oranga Tamariki without any support. That's absolutely crucial. I mean, we wouldn't even know about this case had it not been for that brave family. And, you know, they've had to put themselves on the line in terms of people know now who they are, whether or not we fixate their faces or things like that. Everybody doesn't, certainly most people do know who they are. They were brave enough to say, bring your cameras in. This has happened once before. We don't want it to happen again. We would never have known that this was going on. And now, of course, it's opened up a can of worms, because what we know through the Māori families, who before have never been asked to say what was the impact, how were you treated, and that's of course the focus of our inquiry, that we know that this is just merely the tip of the iceberg. So what we're saying to our Māori families is now record everything, take someone with you, and do not take this lying down. Get in touch with your whānau order navigators, get in touch with somebody else that you know that can support you as well. In every DHB there is a Māori liaison person. Make sure that person is there. Make sure you bring your kaumātua on, you know, and take older people with you, although I have to say in the past they've been dismissed and pushed to the side as well. But, you know, I think we have to push back on this department absolutely in every way possible.
Whānau Order Commissioning Chair Meripeka Raukawa Tait on Friday's Checkpoint programme. A Bollywood overreaction. That's how Shane Jones has described the Indian community's backlash to his comments last week, where he said migrants could go home if they didn't like the government's new visa policy. The policy cracked down on the partnership visa category, meaning couples must have previously lived together to bring their spouses to New Zealand. But the Indian custom of arranged marriages doesn't fit that mould. Shane Jones joined Corin Dan on Wednesday's Morning Report.
Do you need to de-escalate this situation? This is becoming pretty ugly.
I don't think that I need to walk back anything I've said. I'm a proud retail politician. With my whakapapa, I go back 1,000 years in this country. There were some activists from the Indian migrant community who insulted my leader and who attacked our party because of our government policy. Hello, hello, this is New Zealand politics, and you don't get a free hit on the party that I belong to.
Yes, but aren't you unfairly singling out one section of the migrant community here? And by dog whistling and giving people reasons to attack migrants?
So I've moved on from that shallow assessment, and I'm now taking this weekend to our party caucus retreat a proposal to campaign unstintingly next year on a population policy. In the last 5 years, we've added nigh on 500,000 people to our population. Now, I know I won't get much support from the majority party, certainly not from National, because this was a part of their economic development recipe. But I say to all your listeners, we're capped out at 5 million people at a time where the birth rate is actually lower than the post-war boom. How many new Kiwis do we want? What talents should they bring? Now, I don't care if some of the rhetoric is dismissed as fiery. I'm a professional politician belonging to
Mr. Jones, the issue is, look, no one, by all means, have a debate about population, but when you single out one group, Therefore, that gives those who are perhaps grumpy about migration the opportunity to target that group. And that's what the Indian community is worried about.
Okay, I will gladly meet with the leaders of the Indian community. The people who sought to insult our Prime Minister at a recent Indian event, don't bother coming if you don't want to be treated by me in a similar fashion. But I'll go anywhere and debate these issues with any migrant community. The point that I'm making is that this is government policy. This is the policy initiated by the National Party, moderated by our government, that we are not going to acquiesce or tolerate legions of parents and grandparents coming to New Zealand, queue jumping and clogging up our social services. That's why we've made an 1,000-person allocation for the parental visa reunion category. That's government policy.
But who said that the Indian migrants were bringing the whole village to New Zealand, as you put it?
The activists said that they feel that they're not wanted in New Zealand, so they may as well leave. Well, if anyone's going to make that threat, I just said to them, don't hang around.
If we look at the actual issue itself around arranged marriages, is it a lack of cultural understanding here? Because the issue seems to be that there is now an increased requirement to show that you are living with somebody before you've been married, but that doesn't fit for the Indian community.
Please talk to garden variety Pākehās today, who I can tell you I have come across in large numbers since 2005, who go through extreme processes in many cases to bring their foreign partners in as wives or husbands. Ask any MP and they will say this is not purely an issue about the immigrants coming from India. Their activists are the ones who highlighted this issue.
Yes, but the issue
is... I've got to finish off my corridor.
Okay.
They're the ones who have taken to protesting and attacking. It's totally reasonable for the administrators of the immigration system to want to be confident that this type of arranged marriage, and let's face it, for the basic Kiwi, it is a foreign concept. I know us Māoris, we had arranged marriages 200 years ago, but we've had to adapt, and other people should adapt.
But just if I could just come back to the point, though, the problem is if there are some legitimate arranged marriages, which there are, and Immigration New Zealand recognises that, but how are they supposed to live together if they can't come to New Zealand in the first place?
Well, the first principle is that people wanting to come to New Zealand have to accept we have beautiful, brilliant, and highly appealing qualities about being New Zealanders. So they can't impose directly from Calcutta a concept that us Kiwis never grew up with. And I'm entitled to say that, and I'm going to continue to say
that. But did your parents or my parents or others live together before they got married? That wasn't a norm, was it?
Well, I'm on my second wife, so the less I talk about marriages, the better.
But is it not just a cultural difference that's getting lost in translation here?
So I think you're actually right, and what you've done is you've put your finger on the pith of this issue. This is about the changing nature of our societal culture through immigration. And I am absolutely empowered with my particular ancestry and lineage to raise these issues in the context of a population policy for the future face, size, girth and wealth of New Zealand. And you're going to hear a lot more about this from me next year.
Okay. Ian Lees-Galloway, the Minister for Immigration, has signalled he's going to make changes. Are you going to agree to those?
Well, I'm not the immigration minister, and obviously this issue arose when the activists, the radicals, attacked our party at our party conference. This is where this came from. So this is why I'm taking these issues back to our caucus. I'm not the immigration minister, and I've no idea what the Prime Minister or the Deputy Prime Minister and Mr. Lees-Galloway might be doing about ensuring that arranged marriages aren't an opportunity to rot the system. I don't know about that. I'm talking about something much deeper than this.
But would you expect to be consulted about any changes to this policy in light of these concerns raised by the Indian community?
Oh, well, I'll be taking that issue to our caucus. And generally, we rely
Well, caucus is one thing. What about cabinet? I mean, this, I'm just trying to get a sense as to whether you're going to prevent any changes.
I think you're asking a very good question. And first we discuss these matters in caucus, and then ordinarily it's the we rely on the leader and Tracy Martin. They work very closely on these social development issues, more than I do. I'm more into industry, jobs and the provinces.
So you're not going to stand in the way of any changes that Ian Lees-Galloway might make to appease the Indian community's concerns?
Well, obviously the immigration policy, as it stands at the moment, is government policy. So I've no idea what our immigration minister may be looking at, but it's totally within his rights to call for a report. What actually are the facts of the issue? Because the facts have got lost as a consequence of the vehemence coming from these radicals, and they sadly think that by throwing cruel things around in my direction, that I'm a fascist and I'm a racist, they're going to keep me quiet. They sadly mistake the country they live in if they think they're going to shut me up.
New Zealand First MP Shane Jones on Morning Report. You're listening to The Week in Review. Still to come, the disputed land at Ihumātau could be granted the highest level of heritage recognition, and Auckland Arts Festival announces its 2020 lineup.
I got to see it at the Sydney Opera House last year, and the crowd just went absolutely wild, and we knew we had to bring it to Auckland.
Still to come in The Week in Review. New Zealand has finally secured an enhanced free trade deal with China, although there's not yet a dollar figure on the financial benefits for local exporters. It will make it cheaper and easier for exporters at the border and will give the forestry sector some tariff reductions. The quid pro quo is changes to the visa scheme for jobs here, including tour guides and Mandarin language teachers. The news came in the middle of the East Asian Summit in Bangkok. Our political editor, Jane Patterson, is there. She filed this for Tuesday's Morning Report.
Can I say it is very good to see you again, and also thank you again for hosting us.
The New Zealand delegation was all smiles as Ms Ardern sat across the table from Chinese Premier Li Keqiang with the deal already done. She told reporters it was a breakthrough.
After 3 years of negotiation, excellent to see the China FDA upgrade now concluded. Essentially means that New Zealand has the best access, really, of anyone in terms of our agreement.
The upgrade has been years in the making and is aimed at improving the agreement signed in 2008. There will be new rules, basically making it easier and cheaper to get export products over the border, which the Agriculture Minister, Damien O'Connor, says is important for exporters.
I think there was an inconsistencies with the different ports. This will hopefully bring some consistency, and especially if you're moving fresh produce, these shorter timelines are really important.
Another sector that's been keenly eyeing the upgrade is forestry. There have been tariff breaks on raw products into China, but not on processed products. This deal will deliver tariff reductions on $36 million worth of wood and paper exports a year that will come in over the next decade. David Rhodes from the Forest Owners Association says it's good news.
The China FTA was always supposed to deliver these sorts of benefits, and it's really good to see that has come to fruition. I know that these negotiations are never easy.
Not impressed by the deal is former Trade Minister and National MP Todd McClay. His party has dubbed the new agreement the 1% deal.
I think the government has rushed this deal through because they're worried about the relationship. We now need to look to where they will turn their sight.
And he says other prospects aren't looking much better.
RCEP is not going to deliver much for New Zealand, particularly in dairy. I know the European Union have made an offer on agriculture and dairy that actually is so subpar that our officials don't know what they're doing.
One trade-off is a change to the rules that will allow more Chinese nationals to work here as tour guides or specialists and Mandarin language teachers, but within the current visa allocation. Ms Ardern says there was little New Zealand could offer in further trade liberalisation.
New Zealand does allow that free flow of goods because, of course, on principle we believe in free trade, and so we model that in the way that we allow exporters into our market. But that hasn't stopped us from being able to get an excellent outcome with this China FTA upgrade.
And she can't yet put a dollar figure on the expected gains.
We absolutely underestimated the benefit of the original China free trade agreement. And now time will tell how beneficial these additional arrangements will be.
There have been no changes for dairy, with the government believing the sector had as good a deal as possible under the original agreement. While the terms of the upgrade have been agreed, there are still some final touches. The draft text has to be legally verified. The signing and release of the text are expected early next year.
Our political editor Jane Patterson with that report from Morning Report. And in developments overnight Tuesday, there was a significant step forward on the regional trade deal known as RCEP that you heard Todd McClay refer to in Jane Patterson's piece. In the final hours of the summit, the leaders of the 16 countries completed negotiations on the text, but importantly, a key player, India, is still not locked in. Jacinda Ardern and Damien O'Connor spoke with reporters late on Monday night about the long battle to get the deal signed.
I've never gotten a sense that it ran the risk of falling away altogether. I mean, this is a hugely significant agreement. It would be the largest that there is once concluded. And so I've never sensed that it ran that risk. But there has been, I think, a growing impatience to see conclusion. We saw that when Singapore was really hosting those negotiations, and we continue to see a real desire to see it concluded. And I think now we're getting to the point where we will very soon.
What are the benefits over and above the individual bilaterals? I mean, and this is obviously with or without India.
Mm.
But what are the extra benefits on top of those?
I mean, yes, it will, because it will create a structure, some rules of trade among half the world's population. And from a regional perspective, there's a lot of interaction between the countries, among the countries, and that will simply give certainty for businesses that are looking at to any one of these 16 or 15 other countries if they looking to grow their export opportunities. So that certainty and the structure that this will create is the way forward and the growth opportunities that New Zealand should enjoy. If at some stage in the future India say that they can't join up, then the 15 other nations have committed to move on.
How confident are you that you'll be able to get a deal, a bilateral deal, between New Zealand and India?
Well, we're not talking about that. We would rather have a plurality.
You'll be able to resolve the issues that New Zealand has.
I think we will be able to resolve the issues. We've had some very useful discussions. We've been quite upfront about the fact that, we would need to have dairy as a part of any agreement. And they realise that, we're not going to export all products in a competitive way. It's a complementary way. And we just have to sit down and agree on the product lines that they'll allow us into their countries.
15 other countries around the table, though, so there are other significant players that India will need to continue
to... the least ambitious agreement that New Zealand's been part of?
RCEP?
Yeah.
Well, obviously, just by default, we already have bilateral arrangements with the countries who are part of RCEP. So I'm not sure that's a fair judgment to make against RCEP.
I think at the signing it might not give the immediate benefits, but long term it probably has the greatest potential.
Damien O'Connor and Jacinda Ardern speaking from Bangkok, as heard on Tuesday's Morning Report. National MP Joanne Hayes says Māori could end up better off if their welfare payments were reduced. She says people have been telling her a party discussion document that talks about getting tough on beneficiaries is racist. But Mrs. Hayes says social welfare hasn't necessarily proved a good thing for Māori. Our Māori news correspondent Lee Marama McLaughlin filed this for Friday's Morning Report.
National's suggestion it might look at cutting benefits of gang members and sole parents has drawn criticism that such a move would disproportionately hurt Māori and their children. But the party's Māori development spokesperson Joanne Hayes says the welfare system is no good for Māori anyway.
I think that we have become so dependent on benefits that we have, as a nation, I guess, we have actually lost the ability to be entrepreneurial and to be able to make our own way in life.
She says Māori need to be more resourceful with what they have, and cutting benefits could actually strengthen whānau.
It could do. It depends on how resourceful the whānau are at being able to do the things for their whānau within the amount of money that they have. Sometimes you don't have to be overly rich to actually live a good life. That's where we fall down a little bit, because we're not resourceful as a whānau. We need to be.
National published its social policy discussion document last week. Proposals it's seeking feedback on include blocking gang members and their associates from the dole if they can't prove legal income or assets, and cutting benefits for sole parents who do not vaccinate their children. The director of the Māori Council, Matthew Tukaki, is amazed by Mrs. Hayes' response to the ideas. He says she's out of touch.
Jo is living in a fantasy world way back from whenever, where things must have been easier for Joe. Well, things have not always been easier for every Māori family across the country. Some of our people genuinely struggle day to day. It's irresponsible from a Māori Member of Parliament who's been there for a while now, who should know better.
National's newcomer, botany candidate Christopher Luxon, wants the no jab, no pay policy extended beyond sole parents to people who receive Working for Families grants. And the party's leader, Simon Bridges, is open to it. Mr Tukaki says it's a classic case of Māori bashing.
The dog whistle politics are terrible. It's like, you know, the former Air New Zealand CEO, Luxon, talking about all this on Radio New Zealand the other day. I mean, seriously, is that how you want to come into politics? Just by bashing and bashing and bashing the same old people that get hurt from this sort of negativity all the time?
The president of the Māori Party, Che Wilson, agrees. He says it's common for politicians to tout policies targeting Māori and the poor in the build-up to an election in a bid to win votes from the right. Mr Wilson says what National is talking about is a form of state bullying.
This is a deliberate target at trying to beat up on people who are struggling already and who actually need help, not abuse. And the fact that National is trying to come up with ridiculous ideas like this is missing the point, because you have to help intervene with people to give them a chance rather than give them punishment.
Che Wilson says if the Māori Party gets back into Parliament, it might have to think twice about working with National if it's throwing ideas out that he says are racist.
That report from our Māori News correspondent Lee Marama McLaughlin on Morning Report. Victims of the country's largest Ponzi scheme are angry that proposed insolvency laws have been shelved, leaving future investors vulnerable. In May of last year, the Commerce Minister, Chris Farfoy, hinted giving liquidators the power to take back more money for those who lost everything. But there's no mention of Ponzi-specific policy in the latest list of changes, leaving former victims furious. Our Christchurch reporter Nicholas Poynton has the story.
Bruce Tichpin was among those who lost money in New Zealand's largest ever Ponzi scheme when Ross Asset Management collapsed in 2012. He now represents the hundreds of other investors who lost close to $100 million. He's frustrated the government has decided to not specifically target Ponzi schemes.
We were promised Ponzi-specific legislation that was very crisp, very clear, very fair, and would have provided a very, very quick settlement.
He says this leaves small investors vulnerable in a market he describes as the Wild West.
It is just completely unsatisfactory, and with proper regulation and environment that focuses on the human needs of investors, not the best interests of liquidators and lawyers.
The Commerce Minister, Chris Farfoy, says addressing Ponzi schemes would have held up the other fixes to insolvency law.
Well, certainly the Ponzi scheme policy area is extremely complex, so I apologise to Mr Tichman that we weren't able to get it out in the time frame that he wanted to with the measures that we've already announced, but they were much easier to get through. As I say, we can still continue to look at the Ponzi schemes. They will take a lot more time than the other insolvency issues that we've dealt with.
Victoria University law lecturer Victoria Stace says it's sensible for the government to make straightforward changes now. She says Ponzi schemes are incredibly complex, and finding the best way to legislate against them will take time.
It might be that insolvency law is not the place to deal with it, that it might be better dealt with in some respect through the Financial Markets Conduct Act, for example, in particular because of the fraudulent aspect of the management of the scheme.
The changes will be included in the Insolvency Law Reform Bill.
Nicholas Poynton with that report from Wednesday's Checkpoint programme. The disputed land at Ihumātau could be granted the highest level of heritage recognition by Heritage New Zealand. It's proposing to change the heritage status of the neighbouring Otu Atawa stonefields to a Category 1 and expanding the current boundaries to include the land at Ihumātau. That land is at the centre of an occupation that's gone on for more than 100 days, trying to stop a Fletcher housing development. Andrew Coleman is the Heritage New Zealand Chief Executive. He joined Corin Dan on Tuesday's Morning Report.
Why is this proposed change being looked at?
Oh, purely and simply because in 2017, three individuals sought a review of Otoatoa Stonefields listing as it stands today, which is as a Category 2 heritage place, and they think there's some merit in us reviewing that, and as we're obliged to do, we've undertaken a review of that, which has come out in the proposal to have it increased to a Category 1 heritage place.
So what does it mean if it goes to Category 1?
Well, in effect, it means nothing by way of protection, but it is the best informational base that anyone will have on a heritage determination for Otoatoa Stonefields. In 1993, the Act then allowed archaeological considerations to be taken, but pleasingly, in 2014, the considerations for heritage became much broader, and it allowed us to undertake a deeper review, in effect, of the information related to spiritual, cultural, traditional significance of this land, which we think has warranted it being increased from a Category 2 to a Category 1 heritage place.
But the change for Otoatoa Stonefields, it extends a little bit into the land that is disputed as well?
Oh, absolutely. So one of the recommendations we're seeking consultation on is the category listing from 2 to 1, as I said. The second part is to expand the land holdings. The original historic reserve area that is Category 2 of Otoatoa Stonefields, there's quite a recommendation of quite an extensive expansion, including land as we know it around Puke Te Papa and Ihi Mātou, land owned by Fletchers, land in private ownership, and land going out to the boundary of the Manukau Harbour.
But the change to status one does not affect what Fletcher Building could or couldn't do on that land?
No, absolutely. Our informational listing review has no impact on any designation for special housing area. What it does do is it allows a conversation with a much deeper and richer understanding of heritage to be had with others, landowners, Auckland Council in this case, and anyone interested in the site.
It would, though, appear to back up some of the arguments made by the protesters that this land has far more cultural significance perhaps than some had recognised.
Oh, I think that's right. And in fact, the report, which is publicly available on our website now, people who are interested in commenting on it or providing feedback will see that it is a deep, deep, rich cultural and traditional significance to New Zealand and to Māori.
I'm still trying to get my head around then, if that is the case, why do the special housing area pieces of legislation and other bits and pieces that allow Fletcher Building to build on that override that?
Well, in effect, our judgments made under two different pieces of legislation. Our judgments are always under the Heritage New Zealand Pohiri Tāonga Act. That's the act that prescribes listing, as it does also the archaeological regulatory process. The Resource Management Act is the act that controls protection, and that's not something that we have a direct relationship with. We work with others who have that responsibility.
But at Status 1 or Category 1, it does give the land greater mana, greater, there would seem to be greater urgency or importance placed on that to look after it.
I think the word I'd use is a greater heritage recognition. We know from the work that we've done, and that's what we're seeking consultation on, that it has absolute recognition as a heritage and very significant heritage place for New Zealand. That's the thing we're testing. That's an important, a really important informational statement around the significance for heritage and the history of this land.
So what next? Does anything else have to happen?
Oh, we're seeking consultation, so we anticipate over the next 4 weeks, closing on the 29th of November, that we'll get a lot of input into the judgments that we've made. Those then get prepared to go back to the board and Māori Heritage Council of our organisation, Heritage New Zealand Pohiri Tāonga. They, the board and council, will then make a judgment based on the feedback we've got in the initial positions that we hold, and then they will make a determination around our final listing category for this place, and also as to whether the area of significance should be expanded.
Heritage New Zealand's Chief Executive Andrew Coleman on Morning Report. Sonny Bill Williams has signed a deal with Canadian league side the Toronto Wolfpack. The Wolfpack is funded by Australian mining billionaire David Argyle and plays in the English Super League. With a baby in his arms, he sent this message to his new teammates.
Hey guys, Sonny here. Just a quick message to the Toronto fans and team. I'm looking forward to getting over there. I just want to say that I'm not coming over for a holiday. although my son might be. I'm coming over to do some work, and God willing, we can have a successful season on and off the field. Cheers, guys.
Sonny Bill Williams. Our correspondent in Toronto is Laura McQuillan. She joined Susie Ferguson on Friday's Morning Report.
So it's official. The deal is done.
It's finally done. So we've been hearing 2 weeks of speculation on this. Is he coming? Is he not? Is this just a negotiation through the media? Well, now we have it confirmed. He is coming over here. As you heard, not a holiday. He's coming over to do some hard work. And funnily enough, today's the first snow day of the winter. I just hope he knows what he's getting himself in for once he's here.
Absolutely. Just reading through some of the statements that have been put out around this, you'd expect statements to come from coaches and owners of clubs and that kind of thing. But this is coming from all of those, plus the Toronto mayor, the head coach of the Kangaroos. This is a really big deal.
Yeah, it's interesting to see the mayor putting out a statement, you know, rejoicing about how much this is going to bring to the city. A city that's hot off the heels of winning the NBA championship, and to see the city excited about a sport that people don't really even understand here. You know, I'm forever explaining to people what the difference is between the Wolfpack and, you know, what the All Blacks do. Different code, but now raising the stakes for this team and certainly raising their profile, one of the biggest rugby names in the world. And that's what they wanted, right? They wanted a big name as they head into the Super League. 3 years they've been working towards this. They've made it to the big time. They've got that big name. And with that, you know, it comes big sponsorship. And certainly they'll be hoping to capitalize on, you know, taking his name out there, getting more deals, getting more bums on seats in the crowds. It's a really exciting day for the team.
So is it clear what position he's going to be playing?
That's not a clear one as yet, but I mean, I guess he can probably take his pick, to be honest. What we do know is that because he's one of their two marquee players, he's certainly going to be getting paid the most. And that will mean he's actually bumping someone else from getting, you know, this great payday, potentially one of the older players who's signing off from the team. So it's going to be interesting to see that. But certainly when he does take to the field, it's going to be an interesting one to watch. We know it's a 2-year deal for the next couple of years, but we'll be waiting for more news. And it seems like he might be trotted out pretty soon. They're going to be doing a bit of a special press conference with him in the day ahead in the UK, because this is a team that's transatlantic. They're based half in the UK, half the time here. So he'll be, you know, put out in front of the media, potentially in his kit for the first time tomorrow.
Just remind us of where we're at regarding the season. When could his first game be?
Yeah, so we're looking around March or April, I believe. And so it won't be in Toronto for a couple of months because it is so chilly here around that time of year. So the first bunch of games will be played in the UK. Then they'll bring him over here. They already, you know, fill up the stadium pretty well here. So they'll be hoping to be installing some extra chairs once they get the team on the ground here in Toronto, once the snow clears, of course. But certainly, I mean, the Super League, rugby league as a whole, it's not really a growth sport like you see with rugby or with other sports right now. But they'll be hoping to bring in someone, you know, that they're comparing to LeBron James, to David Beckham, that's going to raise the profile of the league as well. And this could be, you know, a boon for the Super League too.
That's our correspondent in Toronto, Laura McQuillan, on Friday's Morning Report. That's Wailing by Dee Dee Smash. And on Monday night, Dave Dobbin's manager Lorraine Barry was amongst the winners of the New Zealand Music Artisan Awards. Ms. Barry won New Zealand Music Manager of the Year for her long career with Dave Dobbin and most recently with the Avondale Bowling Club's Tom Scott. It's the fourth year for the awards, which recognise the behind-the-scenes talent of the country's music industry. RNZ Music's Yadina Saw was at Wellington's Massey University where the awards took place. She filed this.
Tuis were awarded for Best Engineer, Album Art, Music Teacher, Video and Producer. For the first time, the Music Manager of the Year Award was handed out alongside these Tuis that honour the achievements of those behind Aotearoa's musicians. Winner of Manager of the Year, Lorraine Barry, who has managed Dave Dobbin for the past 15 years, was overwhelmed by her win and puts the pair's successful partnership down to an absolute trust that they share.
We share every goal. We have never argued about anything on the way forward. So it really, really has been the perfect match. I mean, Dave gave me a new lease of life. I came to New Zealand. I had no idea what I was going to do. And, you know, we started to work together, and here we are 15 years later. And it just, he helped me reinvent myself. And it's something now that I'm doing with the same passion 15 years later. I'm in awe of Dave, and that obviously helps.
Barry, who also manages rapper Tom Scott, oversaw his critically acclaimed Avondale Bowling Club release, which picked up the Best Engineered Tui for Ben Lawson and Vivek Gabriel. Best Producer winner Josh Fountain said that his win was a dream come true since he'd first seen the award as an audio engineering student.
My mains tutor, Angus McNaughton, had just won for his work on SJD. And I remember I was sitting right at the back of the class, and I remember, and I couldn't believe he'd bought it a Tui, and the actual Tui. And I thought, wow, okay, that's going to be my goal. I'm going to win that award one day.
And 15 years later.
15 years later, I have.
Loud cheers erupted from the audience when Duncan Ferguson of St Andrews College won the Tui for the Music Teacher of the Year. The Christchurch teacher was accompanied by some of his students who were attending the industry workshops held earlier in the day. Mr. Ferguson emphasised the importance music played for his students after the mosque attacks in March.
My students, they wanted a way of expressing their grief, and I didn't quite know how, so they got together and wrote a song. And so three of my students wrote a song called Song of Hope. They just wanted to try and get these emotions that they're dealing with, and or not knowing how to deal with, and being okay with it. Let's just get them out in song and write a song about it.
We are people, we have joy, we have power.
The night included performances from local soul singer-songwriter Louis Baker, as well as Massey students. More Tui trophies will be awarded next Thursday when the Vodafone New Zealand Music Awards take place at Auckland's Spark Arena.
RNZ Music's Yara Nasor with that report from Tuesday's Morning Report. And finally, in the Week in Review. That's the Los Angeles Master Chorale performing the Renaissance masterpiece Lagrime di San Pietro, which is on the programme for the 2020 Auckland Arts Festival. Other events include an acrobatic spectacle at the Auckland Domain, a Snow White ballet with costumes by Jean-Paul Gaultier, and a reimagining of a rom-com wedding from a First Nations perspective. The festival's artistic director, Jonathan Bielski, was in our Auckland studio. He joined Susie Ferguson on Wednesday's Morning Report.
What's your personal highlight?
Oh, look, I think the piece you were just playing, the Lagrime di San Pietro, it's just a sublime, extraordinary experience. The opera director Peter Sellers has made this with the Los Angeles Master Chorale, and he's put movement to the choral music. It's just a masterpiece. It's going to be beautiful in our concert hall.
The Snow White Ballet, it sounds like, if nothing else, the costumes will be pretty spectacular.
Yes, well, this is Jean-Paul Gaultier who has created the costumes. It's a very big, spectacular ballet. It's the Grimm Brothers' Snow White, and it's quite a thrill. It's been all around the world. I got to see it at the Sydney Opera House last year with our CEO, David Innes, and it was a sold-out season, and the crowd just went absolutely wild, and we knew we had to bring it to Auckland. It's a real entertainment knockout.
Now, the opening night event sounds also like it's going to be something very special with a lot of te reo Māori.
Yes, we have a program that's headed up by our creative associate, Tama Waipara, which is Toitū Te Reo, and this is where we are looking to celebrate te reo through the festival platform. And the way we start the festival is to kick off with Tira, which is a big public waiata singing event. So people learn waiata in advance and come along and sing with thousands of others in the square. It's a wonderful, uplifting event, and we're kicking off with this year with Holly Smith and Hātia Kapahaka.
So are you anticipating that a lot of people will join in and this will become a huge kind of interactive event?
Well, it is. So we've been working with community choirs all across Auckland. So people will be able to learn over the next few months, ready for the Tira opening night on the 11th of March. But also you'll be able to just go along and the words will have an app and we'll have karaoke on the screen so you can follow the bouncing ball. The wonderful thing about singing along waiata with thousands of other people, it doesn't matter whether you're in tune or whether you know the words or whether you've done any preparation, it's just an uplifting and joyous occasion to kick off the festival.
The Auckland Art Festival's Artistic Director Jonathan Bielski speaking on Morning Report. And that ends this edition of The Week in Review. The next program will be available to download next Friday evening, New Zealand time. You can also catch up on the week's sporting highlights in the podcast Extra Time from RNZ Sport. All podcasts at rnz.co.nz. For now, from me, Paul Brennan, kia pai te wiki, have a great week.